The Hebrew Order of David is one of our community's oldest and most established global outreach organizations. Join Stan Clare for the next hour as he explores the issues facing the men in the community. The HOD Hour is a fundraising initiative for the HOD. Welcome to the HOD Hour with Stan Clare.
And I'm Stan Claff, and I'm the Grand Secretary of the Hebrew Order of David International. And I have as a guest tonight a cousin, Sharon Claff, who lives in London, is an activist with an organization called Campaign for Truth, which has as its mission to analyze and promote understanding of major issues in the Jewish diaspora, Israel, and the Middle East. Welcome, Sharon.
Hi, Stan.
And I understand David's not well.
David's not well. No, just that's an echo. Can you hear an echo?
An echo, echo, echo. Not really.
Okay, I can hear myself twice. Yeah, David's not well. I've had to take him to hospital. He's got a bit of pneumonia.
Okay, can you hear me? I wish him well. Yeah. Yes, thank you. A foot flamer.
So I had to dash him there, and hopefully he's going to be all right. He's been in and out the last few days, so hopefully they're going to keep him there and get him well.
Okay, just for the listeners, David is David Claff, a dentist, prominent dentist in London, the husband of Sharon, and tonight we're going to talk about a little bit about anti-Semitism, but two things. Firstly, as the Tour de France draws to an end, it's interesting to note that in the 1930s there was a winner of the Tour de France by the name of Gino Bartali, and he is buried amongst the righteous in Israel because he helped many Jews to hide from the Nazis, from the Italian, etc. And this year they opened a school. It's called the School of Success, the Gino Bartali School of Success in his name, in Israel, near the airport in it. And it's a school for cyclists, so anybody wishing to join should actually make contact with him. Sharon,
hi.
This week, big news in England, the new Prime Minister. What does it mean for the Jews? What does it mean for Israel?
Okay, so I guess you all know that there's been a political upheaval in the UK for quite some time now with the rise of Jeremy Corbyn as the leader of the Labour Party.
Right.
And the anti-Semitism that's going on within the Labour Party. So there's been a great fear in the UK that the Labour Party might win a general election and that we'd land up with Jeremy Corbyn as the Prime Minister. Jeremy Corbyn, as you all know, has notoriously described Hamas and Hezbollah as his friends. And this is really fearful for Jews because we all know what happens in Israel with Hamas and Hezbollah, and we all know what happens also in the rest of the world with terrorism and so on. So I think many in the Jewish community have heaved a sigh of relief that Boris has come to become Prime Minister. Now, and many ask why some of us feel the sigh of relief. They ask the question because they wonder whether Boris really is the Prime Minister for Israel, in support of Israel. But if you look back at Boris's history, when he was a youngster, in fact, in 1984, he was on a kibbutz in Israel with his sister, and he described himself then as a Zionist, as a young man. And so we're all kind of hanging on to that hopefully he'll remain a Zionist. So he, as foreign minister, he carried the government policy of two-state solution, which is official British government policy, with the 1967 borders. Well, they call them borders, but they're not really, they're ceasefire lines. He, like May, didn't think that they should move the embassy to Jerusalem, as the Americans have done. On Iran, he supported the JEPCOA deal, that's the Iran deal. But he has said that that the UK will impose sanctions if Iran breaks that deal. And he recognizes that Iran is a critical power in the Middle East. So I think he's got his eye on the ball there, even though he may not be at the moment speaking the exact language that we need him to speak. because he's a pragmatic man. He knows that the UK needs this deal with President Trump, with America. And we all know that America understands the score in the Middle East. We know what President Trump has done with Saudi Arabia, and how he's brought them in from the cold. And in a way, he's divided, made a big divide within the Islamic states in the area, and brought a crowd of them with towards Israel. And there seems to be a lot of cooperation there. So hopefully Boris is going to be pragmatic. Hopefully he's going, we know that he wants this deal with America. He needs this deal. And I suspect that President Trump will say to him, Boris, there's a real politic going on in the world that you have to understand. And with that goes, Israel is your ally. And therefore, he may well coax Boris to accept Kushner's economic plan for the West Bank, and hopefully what we hope is going to be a good peace deal that's going to be proposed by America.
Right.
So, yeah, I for one embrace Boris. I think he's, I guess because he's unpredictable, that makes him a man for the moment. It makes him a man who is able to see things perhaps that other people don't see.
I was going to say he's about as predictable as Donald Trump, but...
You're not a great Trump fan, you know that.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Just on the score of the cabinet, it's interesting that Dominic Raab is the foreign secretary, is a son of a Jewish immigrant, and Sajid Javid, the chancellor, is the son of a Muslim immigrant. So he's actually balanced out the dynamic within his cabinet. On the right track, is it about?
People are saying that Rob has some Jewish connection. I don't know about that so much.
No,
do you know that for a fact?
Yes.
Yeah, I haven't read that for a fact. I've heard criticism of Rob that he's not exactly pro-Israel or pro-Jewish.
Well, I don't know if he's pro, but he certainly has a Jewish background. His family, whether it is his father or his grandfather, is a Jewish connection, as is Boris. Boris's maternal family were also Jewish.
They were from Turkey, I think, and they had Jewish connections.
Yes.
Look, so, people are very keen always to look for a connection with some sort of Jewish background. I don't mind if there isn't that connection. It doesn't bother me, and I don't see that that necessarily it's going to be in our favor. What I'm hoping for is that we have leaders now who understand what's going on in the world, because there's a big drive not to acknowledge who exactly is the enemy and who is not the enemy.
So the point that I really want to make in this context is that if you look at migration across the world and immigrants coming into countries, in the main and in the past, it's very, very different today, but in the past, there was a move by immigrants in countries where they arrived and they sort of tended to integrate with society and they became part of that society, furthering the actual country, you know, the aims and ambitions and workings of that country. Whereas today it seems that they arrive on the shores and immediately set about looking for ways in which to undermine the political situation, to make a home for themselves in a different way than what we are used to. And so you can take what's been happening in the Democratic Party in America, and you can take what's happening in right across Europe, where, you know, the numbers are increasing and yet the influence is increasing, and the main objective doesn't seem to be to be absorbed into society, but rather to make their own society within that country.
I think there's a different, as you say, there's a different mood at the moment. Times have changed. I think firstly, there's a kind of drive against nationalism, that it's now no longer acceptable to be a nationalist, to love your country, to wave your flag. This has become a no-no, In the past, there was Rule Britannia, and there was America, and people were very proud of their flags and their country and so on, and would gladly go and fight for their countries. Not gladly, but willingly. But this doesn't happen anymore. And we now have a... It's very interesting because Israel is accused of being an apartheid state. But in fact, if you look at the division that's taking place within Western society, if you look at the idea of Black Lives Matter and the fact that there's an accommodation for immigrants not necessarily to learn the language of the country they move to, and to understand that they don't need to, that they've got their own societies. So, for instance, in this hospital that I've just taken my husband to, they're translators for people in every single language you can think of. There's a kind of acceptance that immigrants can come here and not integrate, and a respect for people to be to live in their groupings, which is in fact apartheid. It may not be a legal apartheid, but there's an acceptance that people don't have to integrate, that you can have an enclave in one area of London, for instance, for Hindu people, and another enclave for Muslim people. They all speak different languages. So you can go to school, you can send your child to school, and they may speak 12 different languages in that school. So it kind of filters through society that people don't integrate, but then their children also don't integrate. And they don't feel part of the society that they've come to live in. And they become disaffected. And I think this creates a very big problem. And Boris has actually said, on the hustings during the election for leadership, he said that all immigrants will be required to learn English. Now, I think that's a big bonus. It's a big step forward, that people need to come here and feel that they belong in a country that they belong here as citizens of this country. And that they can communicate, they can participate as British people rather than participate as foreign immigrants from somewhere else.
So is the situation similar in Europe? Isn't it becoming rather more that the views of Muslims are coming to the fore rather than being part of society and integrating? In Israel, you have when people come to Israel, they are taken into an organization which is called for absorption, which means that they absorb you into society. It's not so much in these other countries. It seems to be that they arrive there with the main intent of finding a home from home, and not to be, you know, if you're hankering after coming to places which are thriving, like Europe and the United Kingdom, and you arrive in those countries with the intent of changing the country, I think that's patently dishonest.
Well, this is something that is very interesting for me. You may not know, but recently we Campaign for Truth is an interesting organization because it hopes to bring points of fact to a wider public that they don't normally get. And I guess if we were formed today, we'd call it reporting on fake news. So we try and get behind the fake news and report what we see as truth. But part of what we do is, can you hear me, Stan?
Yes, I just moved around a bit. You're very, very clear.
Part of what we do is we organize events, and we like to bring people or events to a wider public of speakers and films and so on that they wouldn't be able to normally see. So what we did recently, we showed a film called Homelands. This is a film that's made by a member of the European Parliament called Janice Atkinson, and the well-known Katie Hopkins, who, I don't know if you're South African listeners would have heard of Katie Hopkins, but she's a rather outspoken pundit. I don't know what else to call her. She's a pundit. She's got something, she's got an opinion about everything. She used to be a reporter on the Daily Mail and so on, but she got chucked out because she's very candid about her views. And this film is about Islamic immigration and the effects it had on the Jews, mostly in Paris. and she covers the emigration of French Jews leaving France because of Islamic anti-Semitism. You know, the lady called Mireille, what's her name, Mireille Nell, who was murdered, the Auschwitz survivor who was murdered in Paris. Well, she speaks about her, and she speaks about a couple who made Aliyah, and why they left their children in France and went to Israel, and the threats that they felt from the local Islamic population. So, for me, Islamic anti-Semitism is the anti-Semitism to be cautious about today. But unfortunately, we have a broader society that doesn't recognize that. And we're not allowed to talk about it. So we showed the film, and we really got harangued from almost everybody in the Jewish community, and some on social media, in the Jewish press, that we are bigots, that we're right-wing, that we're racist, that we're Islamophobic, that it's no good for Muslim communities for us to show this. But if you see the film Homelands, I think I sent you a link to it. I don't know if you managed to see it.
Yes, I had actually seen it prior to that. I have seen it, and it's a very interesting documentary. If people want to get hold of it, it's called Homelands, and it's really worth a watch. It's interesting to note that one of your critics was Sir Mick Davis, who was a big supporter of the Conservative Party, and now he's resigned. Nobody seems to be able to say exactly why. I don't know whether he doesn't like Boris, or
he said that Boris deserved to be able to choose his own team if he was going to have a unified party. That's what he said.
Right.
But I suspect he was brought in to raise money for the party, and I suspect he didn't raise too much money. That's what I've read.
It seems as if he put a lot of his money that he made from the sale of Xstrata into the Conservative Party.
Yeah,
it's also worth noting that he's ex-South African, having grown up in Port Elizabeth and made good in England, in the commercial world, in mining. So, you know, he has connections with us. And he himself is an immigrant from South Africa, an immigrant to the United Kingdom.
He comes from Port Elizabeth.
Yes.
He apparently comes from parents who belong to the revisionist Zionist organization.
Right.
So they're Jabotinsky supporters.
Yes.
Mick Davis, certainly today, you couldn't call him a Jabotinsky supporter. He notoriously wrote an article about the Israeli government in which, I'm paraphrasing, he reportedly and allegedly said that the Israeli government has to take account of what he feels because what they do affects his life.
Yes,
and of course, we don't agree with that.
Yes.
We don't agree with that at all. So that's his opinion. And he also is part of Portland Trust. And Portland Trust has huge connections across the West Bank. And they, for instance, once again reportedly had something to do with building Rawabi. Have you heard of Rawabi in the West Bank?
No.
In Judea and Samaria. Well, Rawabi is a new town built for Muslims. Can house about 40,000 people. What has happened is the Portland Trust does a lot of work there, a lot of liaison with a chap called Al-Masri. Al-Masri being an entrepreneur in the area who builds homes and big projects and so on. And so they've been building this Rawabi, and they're hoping to bring a pile of people into it. And they have plans to build four of these across the West Bank. So there seems to be a plan to populate the West Bank with Islamic people before there's even a peace agreement.
So
this is what McDonald's is part of that. If you look up Portland Trust, you'll be able to see what they do.
So to
get back to Homelands and this idea that you're not allowed to speak about the threat the Jews feel, where it comes from. If it comes from an Islamic background. And there's a concerted effort in this country to make sure that anti-Semitism is pinpointed on a right-wing attack on Jews rather than a left-wing or an Islamic. attack on genes.
So my context a little bit, just to clarify the context and what we're talking about. From the Hebrew Order of David's point of view, you know, of course we were a totally South African organization, and immigration was to our advantage because members of the organization found themselves in the United Kingdom, they found themselves in America and Israel and even Australia, and that was the opportunity, and Canada, of course, and that was the opportunity for us to expand the footprint of the Hebrew Order of David, and one of our cornerstones is that we stand against anti-Semitism, of course, and assimilation as well, but anti-Semitism, and more it seems that assimilation seems to be connected in some way to the anti-Semitic movements. But what worries us most, and I think that it's a growing problem throughout the world, is that there are so many of these organizations which have popped up truth, with the word truth in it, and you don't know whether they're for or against what everybody's working towards. So Netanyahu made a speech in which he said we should, everybody should light a candle, an extra candle called the candle of truth. And so what is the truth?
Now, that's a really, really good question. How would you describe the truth? Well, truth has different sort of sides to it. The first side is that if something happened, and it's reported, it needs to be reported as it happened, not the opinion of somebody who tries to translate why it happened and whose fault it was and so on and so forth without the facts. And this is one of the big problems. We see this happening to Trump, where people have decided that he's not a good guy, and they're trying to make the truth fit into their perception of him not being a good guy. So they've had this big Mueller inquiry. He couldn't come up with anything. He as much as said so. Now they've got the Democrats looking again into Mueller and trying to get him to commit some sort of truth into the fact that Trump is not a good guy. But Mueller couldn't find any evidence of that. And what we have now of, and this is what happened to us, if you look at that, the report in the Jewish Chronicle about our screening of homelands, the journalist who came there, we knew he was coming, he had bought a ticket, we believe in free speech, so we didn't stop him coming. He didn't take the opportunity during question time to speak to Katie Hopkins or Janice Atkinson, who were there. He didn't take the opportunity to speak to us. He went outside, he spoke to a few members of the audience, and he drew his conclusions and put his own opinion into it, and he wrote a scathing article about us. And we've had a lot of bad news, bad sort of reports because of it. And of course, Mick Davis wasn't at the screening. He read the article and decided that he could also write about it, even though he wasn't there. So if we're going to talk about truth in that context, the reporter had the duty to say, I came along, I watched a film, the film said X, Y, and Z, there were so many people in the audience, the question and answer said this, this, and this. That's what he should have reported. He shouldn't have distorted the fact to suit his own political agenda and put in comments like, we must be bigots and right-wing and all the rest of it. So when you talk about truth in that way, that's a truth that's very easy to keep to. The reporter goes out, he films, he takes a record, he makes a good note, and he writes about it. The other thing is, what the other truth is, when we start perhaps going into the broader context of how we live as a Western society, how we want to live, what is our truth in our lifestyle, in our belief systems, and so on and so forth. That truth is a little bit more not as fixed, if that makes sense to you.
But is it more subjective or is it objective?
It's more subjective. My truth in being a Jew is more subjective in Jeremy Corbyn's view in being a secular anti-Semite.
Is it coincidence that the initials, Jeremy Corbyn's initials are JC, or is that just by the by?
He might not think so. Don't know.
Well, let's let the listeners make up their minds. We're going to take a break for a few minutes to pay the rent. And we'll be back. Don't go away.
This is the HOD Hour with Stan Claff.
And we're back and we're talking about, basically about anti-Semitism. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about Islamophobia, I guess, Islamification of Europe. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can send a telegram to 061-895-1019, or you can SMS the number 34519 and be part of the conversation. We're happy to read out comments, good or bad. Keep it above the belt. And we're talking to Sharon Claff, activist with a campaign for truth in London, and we were last talking about the politics in London and Jeremy Corbyn, and how serious is being anti-Semitic for the future of the Labour Party?
I think the Labour Party is probably a spent force. Now, and I don't know if that's a general opinion that people have, but I think if you remember in the sort of turn of the last, of the 1900s,
it was a liberals bit before my time.
Yeah, exactly. The Liberal Party went through the same thing, and they disappeared and became almost a nothing party. And I think the Labour Party is a spent force. I think for many reasons. I think if we start now for what Jeremy Corbyn has done to it, he's completely split the party. The people who believe in a more sort of enlightened vision of social welfare and so on, through a left-wing agenda, have mostly left. There are a few of them left in the party who think they can change Corbyn. Corbyn has brought in the whole idea of Marxism, which is crazy. I mean, I can't think of any more stupid thing for any political pundit to want to do is to introduce Marxism into the United Kingdom. And I think that the Labour Party is a spent force, and I think it's not just because of the anti-Semitism. We run a page called Jeremy Corbyn Watch, and every time we post anything about Labour anti-Semitism, it doesn't get as big a reaction as any other stuff about Jeremy Corbyn. And we have huge views there. I mean, sometimes we can get a million reach on a post. So I think the Labour Party is probably done for.
And the, I don't know that it's ever. Do you think that an election is in the offing? I mean, it looked as if Boris Johnson was forming a kind of a war cabinet to take on an election. Do you think that it would really appear that the Conservative Party has taken a hammering over the last number of years, and I don't know how much stronger they are than the Labour Party.
Okay, so Stan, I recently wrote a blog that I posted on the Times of Israel, and I called it Nurofen Plus No Longer Works. Now, I don't know if you get Nurofen in South Africa.
Indeed, we do.
You do. So what I was saying was Nurofen Plus doesn't work anymore. I've got such a headache from the chaos that our political system in the UK finds itself in. Absolute chaos. So what we find is that the UK at the moment is rudderless. And people are hoping that Boris is going to get hold of that rudder and see if he can steer the ship in the right direction. In that rudderlessness, is mixed this whole anti-Semitism, and you know the activism that I'm involved in is combating anti-Israel activism, pro-Palestinian activism, and something I call the Red-Green Alliance, which is left-wing anti-Semitism and anti-Israelism that has an alliance with fundamentalism.
So the red being communism, the green being
The green being the Islam. Fundamentalists, the people based on Iranian Islamic sort of ideology. And I guess in that would be white fundamentalists as well.
Yes, Nurofen Plus, what you're saying is an aspirin no longer does the job.
It doesn't cure it anymore. So you have this rudderless political system in the UK. coupled with this, just recently, you may not know that two of our activists were falsely accused of some terrible stuff at a demonstration. They were counter-demonstrating an organization called In Minds, which is virulently anti-Israel, and they had a demonstration against the Puma store. The Puma store apparently provides sports equipment for the Israeli football team.
Yes.
So they were protesting in Carnaby Street, and these two activists went along, and they created a ruckus. If you looked at it in terms of activism, they did a fantastic job. But they were reported for assault, for battery, for all sorts of things. And although this happens a lot to us, that we get complaints from the police that we've done something we haven't done, this time the police actually arrested them, and they found themselves in court. And unfortunately, they took a plea bargain. So they took a lesser sentence for not having a trial. So this was the one thing that I found myself looking at that. And the other thing I'm looking at is we recently had a tour of the UK by a lady called Linda Sarsour. Linda Sarsour, you may know, is an Islamic activist in America.
Yes.
Pro-care, pro all the Islamic organizations, Muslim Brotherhood and so on. And we tried to get her banned from coming to the UK. And one of the things that's coming out of America is that Jews are now considered white. And I'll explain to you what that means. They're considered white, and they're considered white fascists.
Yeah, they're considered to be white and right.
Do you understand what that means?
Absolutely.
And like, there's no such thing as anti-Semitism. It's done. Because white people don't suffer racism. White people disseminate racism. They don't suffer racism. So Jews are considered white, and if you listen to Linda Sarsour, you listen to Omar Ilan and all of those people, you can find them talking about Jews being white. So anti-Semitism's cured. No anti-Semitism. Doesn't exist. So when they talk about Jews, it doesn't really matter. They're allowed to talk about Jews because Jews are white people. So they can talk about the Benjamins, they can talk about Jews owning the banks, etc., etc. It doesn't really matter. Now, the other thing that happens is on the hustings, I don't know if you know about this either, the BBC held the hustings, called our next Prime Minister. And what they did was they had this lady called Emily Metlis, who does Newsnight on BBC program. And she ran the hustings. And this was a stage where I think there were five or six candidates, and it was completely chaotic. She didn't seem to have an agenda, so they were all talking above each other. And then she brought on people to ask questions remotely via Skype or whatever they do on television. So they brought in a lady from here and a man from there. Turns out a lot of them were Labour Party activists. But one guy came along. He was put on, and his name was... It was quite a shock. Imam Abdullah Patel. And Abdullah Patel is a well-known rabid anti-Semite. And he came on to ask a question. And the BBC ought to have known that. Because if they brought in, and his question was about Islamophobia. Now, they didn't have any questions about Christianophobia, anti-Semitism, any religious issues. But they decided to bring on Imam Abdullah Patel to talk about that. And that is a kind of sense that the mainstream media are complicit in this whole idea that you can't talk about Islamic anti-Semitism because it's Islamophobia. So we have that.
When you look at that situation and you take, BBC, Sky News, CNN, it's amazing to see that the people that they bring on to comment are generally well chosen because they have the opinion of the station. They don't have diverse opinion. They don't have an opposing view. It's generally to support. And you can look at, some of especially on CNN where some of these Jake Tappers and Como, people like that who are rabidly against Donald Trump, and they make sure that they mock the government in such an extent that I actually find it sometimes almost treasonous in what they say, yeah. But they bring people on to support that point of view, and they don't bring on anyone with an opposing view. So if you're listening to that, and I'm sure that Fox News is probably just as guilty, but that's why I said at the beginning of this conversation that does one really know what is the truth? You have to make it up for yourself. You know, there's so many different interpretations of the truth, yours, mine, and everything in between, that it's difficult to really see, is all of this happening? I mean, some of the stuff that was in that documentary is absolutely gut-wrenching because, you know.
It's gut-wrenching and it's happening.
And whole towns have been taken over. Yes. And whole towns have been taken over and people have been squeezed out.
Interestingly, she didn't tell, and it's a pity, she didn't tell in the film why she chose Savilltown. Savilltown is a suburb in Leeds.
Yes.
And Savilltown is not only 1% white now. Savilltown is where three of the four 7/7 bombers came from. Now, if you know what 7/7 was, 7/7 it was when they bombed the underground station.
Yes.
It's now 10 years. They had a 10-year anniversary. That's when they bombed it. And sadly, one of Laura, my daughter's friends, was killed in that. So it's very, very close to us. And so she didn't actually tell this. People don't know why she chose that particular town. She could have chosen Tower Hamlets. She could have chosen Birmingham. She could have chosen anything that was perhaps more meaningful to a wider audience. But she chose Savilltown because that it's known that a number of terrorists have come out of that town, and this is the issue. Now, when you talk about news media and what is the truth, you mentioned CNN. We can talk about Sky. We can talk about Fox. BBC is different, and the BBC is different because the BBC belongs to the people. The BBC is not a private enterprise. The BBC, it not only belongs to the people, but it comes with a credibility. It comes with such a credibility that anybody studying at a university and writing a thesis can use the BBC as source material. So this is serious stuff. So when the BBC says something, it's taken as fact. But it's not really fact when we see that they bring on to a program a chap whose agenda they don't tell us about. This is the problem with the BBC.
You're saying basically that it's orchestrated.
It's orchestrated. So somebody can have a PhD in the Middle East and use the BBC as source material. The BBC, in fact, has editors in London that nitpick every single article that comes through out of the Middle East. It's the only area where they have people in London who don't just take copy and publish it, but they look through it and edit it. It's very interesting. This is the thing. And when I look at this picture of the chaos in our political system, when I look at the picture of Jewish activists who didn't commit a crime being taken before the courts and being forced to give in to a guilty plea because they don't have the money to defend themselves, when I look at that, and I look at the BBC, then I ask myself, am I living in a parallel world? You know, and then I see the Jews are now white and they're white fascists and therefore there's no such thing as anti-Semitism. And I say to myself, I spent my life trying to work out how the Holocaust happened. And I think I know now. And I look back, there's a chap called Michael Sebastian who has written some books and he wrote a diary of his time in Hungary when he grew up. And he tells, without an agenda, in his diary, it comes out how gradually Jewish freedoms were taken away from them. And when I see my friends being brought before a court on spurious attacks and accusations, and the police actually taking this as reality, then I have to ask myself, are we heading for another Holocaust?
Because nobody really understands the truth.
Because nobody will accept.
If you look at societies like Jewish societies, they also congregate in areas. I mean, everybody knows where the Jews live, but that's for a different reason. It's for creating, you know, home from home in a sense that, you know, there's shuls, there's, places that's to right. pray, there's schools, there's community things. And I'm almost sure that the vast majority of other races and religions coming to different countries would probably do the same. And I mean, one wouldn't blame them and one would really accept that immigration is an essential part of life today. People move around. It's a pretty mobile world. You can get around. The fact that you want to cross the border illegally or you want to sneak into a country illegally, that's a different thing. But from the point of view of people coming legitimately to countries to come and live there, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I mean, numbers are, I suppose, need to be controlled because with modern means of transport, it's much easier to get there. And so numbers will naturally increase. But at the end of the day, the agendas seem to be completely different. And that is the worrying aspect.
I think if you go to Southall in London, where the Hindu community largely lives, there's nothing wrong with it. You go there and you can go and enjoy lovely Indian restaurants and so on and so forth. There's absolutely nothing wrong with people with a common religion, a common background, wanting to be living in an area where they can go to their temples, they can go to their synagogues and go to their churches. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
Yes, but there changes, is something the wrong changes when to they, society.
When the agenda, when they tell you that the agenda is to propagate, and people won't listen, then there's a problem. When people come here not to live and to share and to enjoy, if you look at Boris's new cabinet, he's got a Hindu, he's got a Muslim, he's got a Christian, he's got all sorts of people in it. And that's how it should be. People should come together and work together to make a prosperous society. And what you do at home shouldn't matter. But when you've got an agenda that says, I'm going to propagate amongst you so that I can become the majority belief system in your country or majority ideology, then if you come here to change the society that you've come to, that should not be acceptable. I've come here as a South African. I didn't come here to make sure they spoke Afrikaans or Sotho or any other language. I came here, and I'm lucky because I came from an English-speaking country, but I came here and I integrated. I joined in the society here. And so if I run my business, whatever I do, I take a job in the city, I work in a hospital, whatever I do, I'm working towards the society that was here when I came here. And what is that society? It's a Christian society. The Queen is head of the church. You know, I came here just as if I go to live in Israel, it's a Jewish society. If I went to live in Saudi Arabia, I misunderstand, it's an Islamic society. And I live according to their rules, their regulations. But I don't go there and say, I wouldn't go and live in Saudi Arabia in Jeddah and say, terribly sorry, I'm going to change you now. You're all going to come to synagogue and practice Judaism. It's not the way to be.
So there have been studies of some orchestrated by or started by South African organizations like the Kaplan Center in Cape Town where they asked a group of people to do a study on the Jews in England, the Jews in Canada or wherever it was. And like last week we had, the Professor Randall Schnur who writes about Jews in Canada. And there's a very, in-depth study of Jews in England and, countering it against the immigration from South Africa was, and United Kingdom, funnily enough, was not the first choice of a lot of those people leaving here. They went, you know, their first choice was Canada, Israel, Australia, etc. I don't think it remains the first choice because of what's going on. So the question is, where is it safe to go? Is it better to stay here where it seems relatively calm? There's a good integrated society, all right? We have different difficulties with government. But that seems to be moving along in a certain way, and hopefully we'll come out on top. But where is it safe?
Okay, so I think when in the 1930s, when Nazism came to the fore, there was a greater world out there. There was a new world. People could go, could leave. They weren't wanted, and they could save themselves. They could go to South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, America.
Not so easily.
Not that easy. And although there were quotas for Jews, which a lot of people don't acknowledge, even into the UK, there were quotas. There were quotas to go to the mandated territory called Palestine. There were quotas. So Jews always had to suffer that. But there was a route to go. Today, the world is a very small place, and the enemy is a different enemy. The enemy is not a nation state that is trying to invade another nation state and expand its borders. The enemy now are people. The enemy now lives amongst us. The enemy is not the ruler of the state, although we've got Iran directing it, but we've got cells of people all across the world who can wake up one morning and get their bomb belts and go on the underground like they did in 7-7 and blow it up. You know, right. Or they can go to the Twin Towers and fly a plane into the Twin Towers. And so how do you assess who the enemy is, how you're going to treat them and so on? And if you're not going to recognize that most of the terrorist acts that happen, and I'm not saying all by any means, and I know that they'll wheel out the one terrorist Goldstein or Goldberg that killed a few people in Hebron. I know they'll wheel out a few people, but the majority of terrorist attacks come out of Islamic ideology. That's the way it functions.
So on that note, we're going to leave it there. We've run out of time as usual. Sharon, it's been a pleasure. I wish David for Schleimer. I hope he's going to be well.
Thanks.
And
thanks,
thank you for coming on and food for thought. And yes, we'll be talking in the days to come.
I think we've got a lot to follow with what's going on here with Boris and his government.
Watching that space carefully.
Yeah. Okay. And love to South Africa. Love to
thank
all
you.
Of you.
Thank you.
And thank you for speaking to me.
Thank you. From a South African point of view and the Hebrew Order of David International, South Africa, we are busy with certain projects. The one that's running at the moment is bringing Yontif Joy, where we collect monies from you, the generous public, and we put that money into foodstuffs, which we distribute together with Kosher Mobile Meals to those in need in areas stretching from Hillbrow, Berea, and throughout Johannesburg, and also, and there are many and a growing number of those who are in need. And we're now also helping in the Eastern Cape. We're coupled with our lodge down there where they're also doing the same collecting, and we're assisting them with injection of money and assistance on those projects. So please, if you're able to dig deep, help us with the funding. The money's going in the right direction. If you need a Section 18A certificate, we're glad to send that. And thank you for listening. It's been a pleasure and educational. I hope you found something, there was something for everybody. The views that are expressed are not necessarily the views of the Hebrew Order of David International, but one needs to know where one stands in the world as Jews and the rising and the rise of anti-Semitism in the world today. Thank you for listening and have a good Shabbos.